alleviating the difficulties that Egypt will be subjected to, and they will be disproportionately adversely affected as a consequence of what's happened, not just by reason of loss of trade and economic revenues as a consequence of sticking with the sanctions, but because there will be many, many Egyptians who formerly were in Kuwait or Iraq who will be returning home or seeking to return home, and there will be a great deal of lost remittances of hard currency to Egypt as a consequence. So we've talked to a number of countries in the Gulf region. We will be talking to others. We have talked to the government of Japan. We have talked to other governments that are in a position to help economically and financially in this effort, that are not in a position to help militarily, and most, if not all, have indicated an interest in and a willingness to assist Egypt.
Mr. Speaker, also yesterday during our meeting with President, Mr. Secretary, our meeting with President Mubarak, he actually discounted Saddam's ability to unite the Arab world in a holy war by attacking Israel. He believes Saddam realizes that retribution would be swift and devastating from Israel and the world, and that the moderate Arab nations would never accept him as the leader of a holy war because of his disinterest in helping them in the past. Would you agree with that statement?
I would tend to agree with that, yes, sir. And I think that a lot has been made about public opinion in Arab countries and the persuasiveness, if you will, of the message that Saddam Hussein is trying to articulate. But it's my understanding, and I think it's certainly been the experience in Egypt and in all of the Gulf states, and in other, in some many other countries as well, that the message is not selling. Saddam Hussein spent the better part of 8 years fighting Iran in the role of a secularist, which of course is what he is, and it was Iran at the time that that claimed the religious mantle. He is now trying to turn that around, and frankly, Mr. Broomfield, I don't think it's going to sell in Egypt. I don't think it's going to sell in the Arab countries of the Gulf, and I don't think it's going to sell in those Arab countries which have joined forces to see to it that this unprovoked aggression does not go unpunished.
Well, Mr. Secretary, again, I want to compliment you on your excellent statement and wish you the very best on your upcoming trip.
Thank
you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Let's see, who we got? Mr. Solars.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Secretary, let me begin by paying tribute to you and the President and your associates in the administration for the magnificent way in which you've responded to this challenge, not only to Kuwait, but to the whole international order by Saddam Hussein. And I fully agree with you that what is at stake here, far more than the price or production levels of petroleum, is the architecture of the new world order in the post-Cold War era. Is it going to be a world in which aggression is rewarded, or is it going to be a world in which aggression is repulsed? And consequently, it seems to me that amidst the complexities and challenges of this crisis, there is one thing which is absolutely clear. We simply cannot permit Saddam Hussein to succeed and to obtain the fruits of his aggression. Consequently, I'd like to begin, Mr. Secretary, by asking you what we will do if it should turn out, our hopes to the contrary notwithstanding, that the sanctions do not succeed in persuading Saddam Hussein to withdraw his forces from Kuwait and to permit the reestablishment of the status quo ante in that country.
Mr. Solars, that's of course very hypothetical, and there are any number of possible hypothetical responses, which I really should not indulge in up here this afternoon. But let me say this. I think that in the long term, in the long run, and even if you assume that they do work and we are successful in moving him out of Kuwait, there has to be a very clear re-examination of the overall security structure for this region, of the balance of power in the region, and of the prospects for equilibrium in the region. Now, that's something, it seems to me, that we're going to be probably faced with in any event.
Well, I can understand, Mr. Secretary, why you might not want to speculate in public about what we do if the sanctions don't succeed, but let me simply say that given the imperative importance of success in this endeavor, I think that you can probably count on the very strong support of the Congress and of the American people for whatever steps are deemed essential in order to liquidate the consequences of this aggression. Having said that, however, I'd also like to refer to your observation that one of our objectives is the establishment of stability in the Persian Gulf and security for the countries of the region. And I'd like to know how you would respond to those who have argued that if Saddam Hussein should unconditionally withdraw his forces from Kuwait, that it would be a rather pyrrhic victory for the international community, given the extent to which that would leave intact his nuclear weapon, chemical weapon, and biological weapons programs, not to mention his million-man army and military infrastructure as a whole. And I'd like to know to what extent you think the elimination of that military potential should become an important objective of the international community as we move toward a satisfactory resolution of this crisis.
Mr. Solars, I certainly think that the circumscribing of that potential is very important, and that's what I meant when I said, in any event, I think we will have to give consideration to working with others to create a new security structure for the region. I think that's likely to be required even if there is a pullback from Kuwait. Back to your other question, I didn't rule in or rule out anything, and I just want the record to reflect that, and I will not. The President has made it clear we're not going to rule anything in, we're not going to rule anything out.
Mr. Secretary, very bluntly, is it possible to eliminate the nuclear, chemical, and biological weapon programs and potential of Iraq without destroying them?
It's not possible to eliminate them without destroying them. It is conceivably possible, I think, Mr. Solars, to come up with a security structure that would make it so clearly to the detriment of any subsequent leader or even the present leader to use or contemplate using any of those weapons that there would be very little risk that they would be used. I mean, I think that is possible.
And what,
clearly, without eliminating them, you can't totally foreclose that possibility.
And what might such a security structure entail?
That's something that we will have to spend quite a bit of time on, in my view, and something that we are already beginning to give a preliminary thought to, Mr. Solars. Whether, as I say, we get him out of Kuwait sooner rather than later.
Mr. Secretary, a few days ago, the Arab countries that have joined with us in this endeavor adopted a resolution in which they said that in order for this crisis to be satisfactorily resolved, not only would Iraq have to withdraw its forces from Kuwait, but Iraq would have to agree to pay reparations to Kuwait for the degree to which they have pillaged and plundered the wealth of that country. And I'd like to know whether we subscribe to that objective.
We have not, the President has not not listed that as one of our objectives, Mr. Solars, and it is not one of the objectives or goals of any of the five UN resolutions. So that is not an objective of ours now. That is a matter, of course, that I think would come into play if, as and when, any negotiation between Iraq and the legitimate government of Kuwait might begin following their restoration to power.
Well, may I say,
that in terms of sharing the military burden, there are now 26 countries that are sending forces in one way or another, or of one type or another, to the region, to the Gulf, whether it's ground, air, or naval. So there's fairly broad responsibility sharing there, and I prefer to use the term responsibility sharing because I really don't think we should see as burdens the task of supporting a friendly nation against unprovoked aggression. So I like to call it responsibility sharing because I think we all have a responsibility. I mentioned earlier that the thrust, one thrust of our diplomatic efforts has been to drum up support from those who can support the actions of those who are going to suffer the most as a consequence of this international consensus. I have pointed to Turkey and Egypt particularly as countries that are going to be hard hit, as countries that stepped up very courageously in the early stages of this matter and demonstrated their support not just in the United Nations but individually as well as in terms of adhering to the sanctions. We will be there. The European community is meeting later this week or early next week to give further consideration to what additional steps they might take. The government of Japan has indeed agreed to supply $1 billion to the effort. Over and above that, the government of Japan will supply an as yet unspecified amount of money to Egypt, Turkey, and Jordan. In addition to that, they are going to be sending some medical personnel and doing some other things. And so I think what we're seeing here is a responsibility sharing effort on a scale that is unprecedented. One of the purposes of my trip, not the sole purpose because I'm going on a combination diplomatic and economic mission, but one of the purposes is to talk to a number of countries about what they might be able to do over and above what they've already agreed to do. And many of them have agreed to do quite a bit. The legitimate government of Kuwait is doing a lot for Egypt, and it's doing a lot for Turkey. And so I'll be having discussions with the legitimate government of Kuwait, with Saudi Arabia, with the United Arab Emirates, with the European community, with our NATO allies, with Germany, and some others. Secretary Brady is in Asia talking to Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. And I think this is an unprecedented effort, Mr. Gilman, and I think we recognize, as you do, that the American people want to know that even though we are the only country positioned politically, economically, and strategically to do this, that we're going to have a lot of help in doing it. And I think we will have a lot of help. Now, that's not to say that it's not going to cost us some money, because it is. But leadership sometimes does cost. It's going to run us probably around $6 billion for the balance of 1990. But that's when you talk about the size of budget that the United States has, when you talk about a gross national product of $5 trillion, it doesn't seem that $6 billion is too much, even if we were not to get any of it, get any assistance from others. It doesn't seem to be too much to exert a rather noble leadership role in this instance.
Well, we hope you will be successful, Mr. Secretary, in encouraging others to be joined with us. What about the Soviet role? There's been a lot of questions raised about, for example, the number of Soviet technicians still in Iraq helping the military in Iraq, some of the supplies that have been going into Iraq. Can you tell us where that stands? They tell us there are a couple thousand Soviet technicians still in Iraq.
Yes, sir, I can. And I've had I've had a number of conversations with my colleague, Mr. Shevardnadze, about this. The Soviets have roughly 8,000 or had 8,000 citizens in Iraq and Kuwait when this crisis began. About 1,000 of these Soviet nationals are involved in some sort of military-related tasks in Iraq, primarily training and maintenance. 193 of that 1,000 are actual military people. The Soviets have said that these people, 193, are going to remain until their contracts expire. We think that, frankly, it's inappropriate to be providing any military assistance to Iraq at the present time, and we will continue to talk to the Soviets about the 193. To the extent that they are free to leave, and we don't know the answer to that because we know that many of our citizens are being detained against their will. In fact, some of them are being used as human shields in a way that is absolutely inhumane and indecent, if you will, by Saddam Hussein. So we don't know the degree to which Soviet citizens right now are free to leave, particularly those under contract to the government of Iraq. But as soon as they're free to leave, we hope that they will depart, and we will continue to talk to the Soviets about this. Beyond that, let me say, as I think Mr. Broomfield pointed out, I don't know where we would be with this effort were it not for the cooperation and the enlightened new thinking of the Soviet leadership, because I don't really think we would have been able to marshal the international support that we've been able to achieve without the Soviet Union. And I hate to think about the degree to which there might have been Arab country erosion if the Soviets had been out doing what they've done for the past 40 years every time the question of the Middle East came up.
Mr. Secretary, just one last question. You, at the last briefing we held, you commented on the extraordinary cooperation by the State of Israel with regard to this initiative. We're talking now about alleviating some of the debt burdens of Egypt, and I'm wondering, as we consider supplying more military equipment to Saudi, some sophisticated military equipment, have we given some thought about trying to maintain a qualitative military edge for the State of Israel?
We've not only given thought to that, Mr. Gilman, that's a commitment of the United States government that has existed at least as far as I can remember for the 10 years that I've been in government, and it's a commitment we intend to honor.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Gadenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, I think everybody here is absolutely thrilled, of course, with the diplomatic efforts as they've been undertaken and the cooperation everybody's spoken about. Let me go and start off saying that I joined them. I think you've done a terrific job, and the administration as a whole has done a great job. There are a few areas that I have some questions in. One is that the whole question where we put our military resources, whether or not this instance should have us refocus the whole NATO question, especially with the changes in the Soviet Union, as to whether or not too much of our defense resources are still going to the wealthiest countries in the world, and whether we would be better off having those available for this kind of situation. Additionally, whether it's time, and I understand that you may be in the process of doing something, of putting Iraq back on the terrorist list, if nothing more than speaking the truth, in that aside from Abu Abbas and Abu Ibrahim and others operating out of Iraq, that the Iraqis almost on a daily basis call for attacks on American targets across the globe. Am I correct in that the administration is now in the process of putting Iraq back on the terrorist list?
They're back on it, Mr. Gadenson.
Terrific. Then,
well, we noted with interest the Iraqi foreign minister's statement recently in Baghdad that Iraq was free of any moral obligations to proscribe acts of terrorism against Americans, British, and French interests.
Let me ask you one about war powers from a procedural point of view, and then about democracy in the region. Well, let me start with democracy. You said it was up to the people of Iraq who heads their government. From all indications, the people of Iraq don't have any great choice in who heads their government, nor do the people of most of that region have a choice of who heads their government. And while in the present time I think you've chosen the right goals without any question, and I wouldn't suggest that they be changed in any way, in the long term, both for our friends and for our adversaries in the region, for the kind of situation King Hussein finds himself in now, wouldn't it be to some degree helpful if the United States now took its focus towards the Middle East and tried to work with these governments to develop democratic institutions? Because in the long term, whether the threat is from a Saddam Hussein or internal fundamentalist groups, unless democratic institutions are developed in the region, that is going to continue to be a region that causes us grave concern. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that generally, Mr. Gagenson, and I think it's, you know, our commitment to democracy is well known, and it's deep and abiding, and there's no reason, in my view at least, why we shouldn't support democracy every bit as much in the Middle East as we do in Central Europe.
Thank you. Let me go now to, well, maybe the most difficult, and to one that even I don't have an easy answer for, and that is how the executive and the legislative deal with each other in this situation, where I think there is general agreement when it comes to war powers. My understanding is at this point the administration's basic position is that the men we have placed in the field are not in imminent danger of being in a war situation. Is that correct, basically?
That that hostilities are not imminent.
Mm-hmm. And so, and it's obviously a problem in war powers, so is it then the administration's position that only when either we've been attacked by an Iraqi force or some other action has mobilized our troops towards the Iraqi border or towards Iraqi plains that the rest of war powers would be triggered? I mean, how do we deal with this issue constitutionally and legally as a country? And it seems we almost have an advantage in this instance because there is such unanimity that maybe we should take this opportunity as we've taken it to work out cooperation internationally. I think what's happened at the United Nations is simply spectacular, and the fact that it's working here hopefully will then be able to transfer it to other regional or individual conflicts. In the same sense, in an area where there's been some conflict between the executive and the Democratic and the Congress, even when it's not been a Democratic-Republican relationship, that there's always that tension between executive and legislative. Is there a way to find a better working relations for war powers in this circumstance?
There's been some discussion, and there was discussion during the course of my confirmation hearings over in the other body, Mr. Gagenson, about the the prospects or potential for amendments to the War Powers Act in a manner that might cure the constitutional problems that the executive branch has with the act. Those discussions really never got off. They began and then they just sort of petered out. I don't know the answer to your question because there is a clear constitution difference of opinion in terms of what the Constitution will and will not permit in this area. So what the executive branch has done, on the basis of my experience again over the last 10 years, is to notify the Congress when the President dispatches troops, tell the Congress whether the executive branch thinks hostilities are or are not imminent, but even if hostilities are imminent, take the position that the 60-day time clock provision that I suppose you would say starts ticking, we think is unconstitutional. And I don't know any other way to handle it right now in the absence of some sort of remedial legislation.
Mr. Secretary, let me interject at that point as a matter of interest. And there is an interesting discussion going on with regard to remedial legislation. I'd be prepared to make a case any time that you don't need any remedial legislation. That the administration in this particular case has acted with dispatch and with propriety in keeping Congress informed fully. And that's one of the major points that's involved in the whole concept of war powers. The other concept is that how you go to war as a nation has changed over the years. We all recognize that fact. We also recognize that the founders of the of this country and the constitutional writers all envision that with the separation of powers, that there is inevitably a shared responsibility between the president acting as chief executive officer and as commander in chief, and the Congress in its constitutional responsibility of declaring war and financing whatever it is that the president needs to carry out. And
for the better part of an hour, Secretary of State James Baker, before the House hearing on the Persian Gulf, answering a host of questions, most of them primarily having to do with how much the Gulf crisis is costing, how much financial help we are getting or that we are about to get, very timely since the Secretary of State is about to embark on a tour of visiting our allies, just as the Treasury Secretary has already done, leaving earlier today, trying to get as much help, financial help as possible in the fight and the increasing cost of what is happening in the Persian Gulf.